special edition of The Cinema Show this week as we touch down amongst the hungry cinephiles ready to devour all that's on offer at this year's Sundance Film Festival.
Especially in that documentary field, it suddenly leads the way and sets the bars for the Oscars and other competitions, and I think also in short films as well. And then, you know, it does also spread its wings into the world cinema category as well.
America's home of independent film has become a launching pad for some of the world's most celebrated filmmakers, but it's also a crucial pot stirrer for issues that the mainstream likely wouldn't touch.
The only reason why films like this are being made is because the continent's changing. I think in recent years, to have a maid or in-house servant, it's not so common anymore as well. So I think people are looking back and say, hold on, that's a bit strange somehow.
Plus, we'll hear from the festival's director of programming on how the curated selection of independent fare comes together year after year.
What we're looking for from all of them is a passionate connection to a film, something that speaks to them, is something they haven't seen before, that creative vision of someone who had to tell this story.
That's all to come on this special Sundance edition of The Cinema Show, your culture guide to the world of cinema on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Ryland, coming to you from Midori House in London, alongside my co-host today, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Faye, welcome.
Welcome, Ben. Thanks.
We're spending today discussing some of the highlights of this year's Sundance Film Festival, which kicked off in Utah yesterday. And coinciding with the event, the clever team over at MUBI have put together an expertly crafted list of Sundance favourites. Subscribers in both the US and here in the UK can catch 2013's It Felt Like Love, which we'll discuss in further detail a little later in the show. And for those in the US, the theme continues. Fernando, what will you be looking out for?
Well, Ben, I'm sorry to say, but there are some South American films that I'm very much looking forward to see, especially The Maid from 2009 that won the Best World Cinema Prize at Sundance for Best Drama. And I have to say, if you haven't seen that film, it is super fun. It is Chilean, and it talks about the story of a maid who works in a family for 23 years. And the family wants to hire another maid to help her. But, you know, she becomes crazy, lunatic, actually, because she's jealous. She said she should be the only one. And then it is quite a crazy film, but also a little bit of a social critique as well. So that's one of my recommendations.
I know you're very excited about that because we're going to discuss that a little bit later in the show as well.
But of course, there are other films. Of course, there's the classic Clerks from 1984. I'm very much looking forward to see that one as well. And if I may mention, there's a Brazilian film by director José Padilha, The Elite Squad, The Enemy Within. A very different story from The Maid because it's quite a violent film. And it tells about some problems in Brazilian society. And that's quite a lot of good films, Ben.
Always colourful content at Sundance and, of course, over at MUBI as well. Before we head any further, though, let's cross to our New York bureau chief, Ed Stocker, who's just arrived at Sundance. Ed, thanks very much for joining us. We tend to hear a lot about the films that play at Sundance. It seems to me it's almost become like the Cannes of independent cinema. How would you describe the manner in which the festival fits amongst some of the other festivals over in the US?
Indeed. Yes, well, it is arguably, by most accounts, the largest independent film festival in the US, I think. Obviously, it's changed quite a lot since its inception at the end of the 1970s, when the broad aim was to promote American film, but also actually promote film from Utah. You know, some people have said in the last few years that perhaps it's got a bit big for its boots. It's essentially a place where the Hollywood razzmatazz, you know, where all the, you know, a lot of the big names from Hollywood get to try out or dust off their snow gear and head up to a Park City ski resort. So some people are saying that it's become quite commercial. It suddenly has perhaps changed in that sense. I think, you know, the people at Sundance are trying to claw that back, but you still get kind of superstar directors who are in town and showing their films. But it's unarguably a great promoter of American independent film. And there's such a broad range of films that are showing at this 2016 edition.
And Ed, I just want to ask, of course, you mentioned, you know, the wonderful rise of Sundance in the 90s with all the indie films. But now, you know, we have so many influential directors. Is it becoming perhaps a little bit too commercial? Or do you think Sundance can still kind of set the global agenda and be very kind of interesting and new compared to the Oscars, for example, or other film festivals around the world?
I think yes and no. I mean, certainly it's very different to the Oscars. It's very laid back. It's very open. I mean, what you can't deny is the fact that it's grown a lot. You know, it started as a very small independent festival. It moved. It became much larger. You know, visitor numbers are getting bigger and bigger. Arguably, some of the films are getting more commercial, but it's still unrivaled in its promotion of independent film from the US. And I think particularly when it comes to documentaries, it often sets the bar. You know, films like Cartel Land that was shown last year, a film about set basically along the border between Mexico and the US, looking at the problems there. You know, that was premiered at Sundance last year. It's recently been nominated for an Oscar. So I think especially in that documentary field, it certainly leads the way and sets the bars for the Oscars and other competitions. And I think also in short films as well. But, you know, and then, you know, it does also spread its wings, as you were talking a little bit earlier, into the world cinema category as well. But when it comes to US documentaries, I think it's certainly unrivaled.
And it does seem as though the 90s was really the golden age for the coming of age of independent cinema, at least in the US. It certainly seemed that when you had the emerging directors like Steven Soderbergh and so on, it really made independent cinema fashionable. Do you think that Sundance is now playing a key role in maintaining that element of fashionability for independent cinema?
Yeah, I think so. It's also interesting when we look at some of those directors, how they've maybe grown. If you look at Kevin Smith, for example, he, of course, directed Clerks. He's back this year with the premiere of a new film. It's also starring Johnny Depp's daughter and also his daughter as well. That's going to be shown at midnight, a midnight screening there. So perhaps showing how far he's come, you know, he's kind of in there with Johnny Depp, showing that he's kind of gone perhaps beyond his independent roots. But it will certainly be an interesting film showing both of their daughters. It's a horror comedy, apparently. So I'm slightly intrigued to see what that's going to be like. I'll be at the screening, so I'll be able to report back at some other point, hopefully.
Ed, I just want to ask you one more question, and it's something we seem to discuss every year, but again, the industry does feel like it's in the midst of some sort of evolution in regards to distribution. The lines between streaming models and production houses are feeling increasingly blurred. You've got Netflix and Amazon almost emulating that old model of the studios owning the theatres in which their films are distributed. Do you expect that that can of worms might be a topic on the minds of some of the filmmakers and industry heavyweights at the festival this year?
Definitely. I mean, I think those people are in town, and what's interesting is, you know, they have a lot of money at the moment. Whether it's sustainable, who knows? But, you know, outlets like Netflix have a lot of money. They are buying up a lot of rights. And it does throw up a lot of questions as well about, you know, whether international competitions need to change. You know, you look at the Oscars, they still need to have a film shown in cinemas for at least a short period of time in order to qualify. So you wonder whether that will be changed in the future, whether it will be more open to streamed content. I mean, some of the distributors are getting around this by putting on very short screenings of their films in a couple of cinemas to therefore then qualify. But it throws a question of whether filmmakers are going to be happy to have the rights to their films bought by streaming providers that then won't necessarily be able to guarantee that any of these films will then qualify for competitions like the Oscars. But it's undeniable that they have a lot of money. There's a lot of competition between them to buy out rights for films. I think the big question, as I mentioned before, is whether that model is sustainable, because it's, you know, it's a subscription service. They have a set amount of money, but it's not like they're actually then making more money from the film being screened if it's subscribers who are watching it.
Ed, we'll let you get back to it for now. It sounds as though you've got a lot on your plate. I hope you've packed plenty of caffeine and perhaps some toothpicks to peg your eyes open.
and lots of warm clothes as well. It's pretty nippy here.
Oh, it's not that much different over here in London. Ed Stocker, Monocle's New York Bureau Chief, joining us on the line there from the Sundance Film Festival. And we'll hear more from Ed a little later in the show. This is a special Sundance edition of The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. Now, MUBI subscribers in both the US and the UK have the chance to catch the charming 2013 drama It Felt Like Love from writer and director Eliza Hittman. The film revolves around Lila, a girl around 15 years old who seems to be trying to emulate the sexual confidence that she sees in her best friend. Let's have a listen.
Hi. Hey. I was just in the neighborhood shopping.
How do I know you again?
The beach.
That's right. You look different.
Yeah.
Do you have a boyfriend?
No.
Kiara's always got boyfriends.
Well, that's different.
Why?
Because she's needy.
Can I ask you something? Do you want something from me?
Well, this is quite a sparse drama. There are long moments of reflection where dialogue takes a break in favour of slow-burning reflection. Fernando, it certainly does seem as though Lila is simply trying to imitate some of the exploits that her best friend seems to wear with such pride. But as the film progressed, I began to think that maybe Lila isn't merely seeing sex as a token of independence and social status. What we're actually seeing here is someone attempting to grapple with her own sexual desires. Faye, what did you make of that?
Well, absolutely, Ben. And I think that's what I thought was so interesting in the film, that it was very female-centered, you know? Because, you know, actually she was the one, I'm not going to spoil the story to the listeners, but she was the one who was kind of hunting the boy she wanted, you know?
This is true. In one way, it felt confusing because at first glance, you see her as being this shy little timid girl and you automatically associate her with being a victim in some sort of world full of male predators. But it doesn't flip that situation. It just looks at it from a slightly more realistic and centered perspective.
Absolutely. You're even mentioning to me that you were kind of scared for her at times because, you know, he was a thug, you know, he was smoking weed and he and his friends were watching porn. So I did feel, oh my God, I thought even she was going to be raped or something horrible would happen. But that doesn't happen. So basically, I think that the director, Eliza Hittman, she just wanted to, you know, to say it's the sexual awakening of a young skinny girl. Because, you know, of course she's a pretty actress, but she's not like, you know, your typical beautiful girl as well. So I just thought it was very interesting and very female-centered, and I think it would be nice to have more films like that in that sense.
I agree, and as you say, I was feeling quite anxious for quite a lot of the film because I think I'd already made up my mind as to where the film was going and was proven quite wrong. But there are several scenes where Lila's attempts to experiment with her desires or perhaps even prove her own confidence to herself lead to some rather dangerous situations. Well, they certainly seem dangerous anyway. So, yeah, I was actually pretty convinced that it was only a matter of time before the rape scene would take place. But no, we're not spoiling anything by saying that, well, of course, there are consequences for what Lila does put herself into. The film maintains some sort of air of class by not allowing itself to sideswipe into any sort of teen melodrama or imitate some form of contrived cautionary tale.
And Ben, I was going to ask, I don't know if you felt like that, but, you know, the cinematography of the film is quite cold in some ways. And sometimes it can be even slightly bleak. I was reading a review of the film and the reviewer, I forgot his name now, he said there's some comparisons with Larry Clark's films, like Kids, in a way. Of course, it's not as controversial and polemic as that, but, you know, it shows, like, you know, teenagers kind of just smoking, kind of isolated in this space, which in this case is the city of New York.
Just talking about the gender politics again, I was kind of perplexed as to how I had judged the boys in the piece because as I was watching it, it did strike me for a little while that the depictions of a lot of these boys feels a little bit one-dimensional. But after the picture had finished, I wasn't quite sure whether I'd misjudged the boys myself or not, because on some level, they certainly do come across as quite stupid, ignorant, one of them in particular quite disgustingly disrespectful. But I think that they're also quite clueless, and perhaps a more mainstream approach might have cast them quite simplistically as simply sex-hungry villains. But I think what was being depicted here was a little bit more complex than that, wasn't it? Perhaps if the film had have taken a little more of a closer look at how their lives were being lived and the kind of influences they had been given, we might have been given a clearer picture as to why their attitudes were the way they were towards women. But this is clearly meant to be Lila's story.
Absolutely. And as you mentioned about the boys, of course, you know, they're not portrayed as beautiful flowers or anything. But, you know, there is a scene where I think I can mention this, you know, where she pretends she had sex with her lover, Sammy. And then when he wakes up, of course, there was a party the day before. So she kind of, he was thinking, oh my God, did I have sex with her? So she was the one who was kind of predating. And that's can be considered a crime somehow. So yes, I like this inversion of roles in a way.
Yeah, definitely a very intelligent way to approach a story like this one. That is It Felt Like Love from 2013 from writer and director Eliza Hittman, which is now showing on Mubi for subscribers in the US and the UK. For any cinephile, attending the Sundance Film Festival can be both exhilarating and rather daunting. With so many films on offer, navigating what to see and when always presents a double-edged sword, knowing that inevitably one cannot see everything. That's a challenge Trevor Groff knows all too well. As the director of programming at the Sundance Film Festival, he's charged with curating the lineup of diverse, culturally relevant cinematic features that have made the event so renowned. In Sundance for this year's festival, our New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker spoke to Trevor about how the festival caters to a crowd constantly hungry for strong, independent voices.
I get such a rush in watching all those submissions, finding the film that you know you want to show in the festival. It is so exhilarating, and every year the films are different and they take on their own life.
There's 120 odd features this year. I mean, there's a massive whittling down process that has to happen. What are the criteria? What are you looking for? What is the something special that you think a film needs to have in order to be selected?
There's a group of programmers. There's about 10 feature programmers, 10 shorts programmers, and all of us contribute to all of the selections. And what we're looking for from all of them is a passionate connection to a film, something that speaks to them, moves them, is something they haven't seen before, that creative vision of someone who it feels like had to tell this story, not because they wanted to be a filmmaker or wanted that, yeah, that experience. There was more something deeper inside of them. Within that, though, you want a rounded program. And so within the festival, we have personal documentaries, we have issue-oriented documentaries, we have artful documentaries, we have comedies, dramas, and films that defy labels, you know. And all of them, though, do have a kind of a special quality, like that you mentioned, that make them stand out from the pack.
And how does it work? I mean, you come up with a shortlist, then you have endless nights drinking lots of coffee in discussion back and forth. How is that kind of final hurdle?
We'll go to a screening room and watch films together. Most of the watching is at home, but we will get together on a weekly basis and have kind of deliberations where we talk about all the films we've seen, pass stuff around, and we just get closer and closer to putting together the program that way. For me, that's the other part of the job that I love, is like that in-depth conversation about these films that you don't get in your daily life. You know, we take such deep dives into the art and the craft that makes all of them really special. I feel like really connected to all of these films and filmmakers after you go through that process and the experience of the festival.
There's been a lot of talk in the press at the moment about diversity with the Oscars. And I know Sundance has always strived to promote minorities or people who don't have enough representation in the film industry. Perhaps you can touch on how you're doing that this year.
I mean, it's no different this year than what we've always done. But like you said, that's at the core of what Sundance is all about. It's about independence. And within that, about diversity, because that's how you get independence. You know, independence is people doing things outside of the familiar, outside of the mainstream. And that's where you get marginalized voices. And Sundance has always strived to provide a platform for that range of voices and styles within film. That's why we've grown to the prominence that we have, is because of that. Audiences are hungry for choice, always have been. Sometimes the mainstream and the studio system lose sight of that. But we've seen it here in Park City and beyond with independent film lovers. They want choice. They want to see films they haven't seen before, from regions they don't know, from people with backgrounds that they are not connected to. And I think that's one of the beauties of film, is to connect people globally at this point, too. Like, We have an international section that we showcase the kind of independent storytellers from different regions all over the globe, but that connect all of us. And when you see the kind of crazy story from some place that you've never been to or didn't know anything about, but you connect to it on a human level, I think that makes the world a better place. And audiences, I think, are hungry for that.
Ed Stocker there in conversation with Trevor Groth, Director of Programming at the Sundance Film Festival. Still to come on The Cinema Show, we'll look at how social attitudes towards being a maid have evolved as we focus on the 2009 Sundance title, The Maid. That's next.
The Arctic is one of the more inhospitable places on Earth, but as Monocle's film crew discovered, there's a trove of stories to be told by the local media about the vast and varied Canadian Arctic.
You start looking at residential school relocation, you start looking at missing and murdered Indigenous women, you start looking at food security and the incredibly high suicide rate here in Nunavut. If we wanted to, as a network, just stick to those stories, we could be the saddest show on Canadian television. You have to balance some of that out with some uplifting stories that show people struggling against those conditions, but winning.
Reporting the Arctic, now showing, along with over 500 more Monocle films and slideshows on monocle.com.
The Cinema Show is presented in association with MUBI, the curated movie site of cult classic and award-winning cinema. Now, Fernando, we were browsing through some of the Sundance titles coming to MUBI in the US over the next few days, and one in particular got you quite excited, didn't it?
Yes, indeed, Ben. And the film that I'm very excited about, and I think it's a great selection for MUBI, is the incredible and very funny Chilean film The Maid, or in Spanish, La Nana.
Mamá, la Raquel me odia. Me odió siempre. ¿Hasta cuándo?
Le voy a decir a tu mamá.
¡Muéstame! Yo también tengo cosas que decir. ¡Tú eres empleado acá!
So this is a comedy drama from 2007, which premiered at the 25th Sundance Film Festival. I'll be looking forward to this when it starts screening on MUBI in the US on the 27th. But Fernando, you're already quite familiar with this title, so fill us in.
I am, indeed. And what I liked about this film, it's because if you are born in South America like I am from Brazil, you know, usually middle classes family, they do have in-house servants. It's almost like some part of the culture, but that's kind of changing somehow. So as the continent's getting richer, I think directors are finally kind of they're finally doing some research about the situation, which is quite funny when I tell to my European friends that for an average middle-class family, it's quite common to have a maid or an in-house servant, whatever. They say, oh, that's a bit weird. And now thinking about it, it is weird. And that's why The Maid, it's somehow a weird film as well. But and I say, of course, there's a social critique behind, but it's a comedy after all. So basically tells, a maid in an upper middle class family in Chile. She's been working with them for 23 years. And we say in those countries that a maid is almost like part of the family. And as you can see in the poster of the film that I have in my hands, it's, you know, the tag of the film is she's more or less family. And basically they decided to hire another maid to help her, but you know, she feels so attached to the family that she becomes jealous of this new maid, and then she starts doing crazy things. She starts kind of the other maid tries to get into the house and she doesn't allow her in, and she becomes almost psychotic in a way. But then the family is confronted with that and they decided to fire her, and then that's when she realized and everybody realized that she's not really part of the family in a way.
Ooh.
And it's a great acting by the actress Catalina Saavedra, which plays the maid. And as I said, there is the funny touch, but again with this kind of social critique behind.
When you say that it has a social critique, how is that being dealt with in the film? Because one would imagine that it was made with primarily audiences of its home country in mind. But of course, being picked up at the Sundance Film Festival, it's then speaking to audiences all over the world. Many of us don't have any experience with this concept of having a maid inside the home. So looking at it from your perspective, but then having lived here in Europe for quite a long time, how do you think that those different themes might be seen by different audiences?
Well, you know, I did mention the social critique like that, but it is very subtle. So, and the thing is, I think with The Maid, I believe even some Chileans might see the film and might not see that there is actually a critique there. They just might see, oh, she's a crazy maid, that she's just jealous. But actually, I think the director, Sebastian Silva, wants to say many more things about it. Of course, the things she does after the new maid arrives are very crazy. I mean, I would fire her if she did that. But I think it's just one to say that she's not part of the family, that this is a hypocrisy, actually, that families do when they have maids and say, oh, you were part of the family, in this very kind of gentle way of dominating someone that it is a bit poorer in a way. It's kind of a modern-day slavery. And as I say, Ben, the only reason why films like this are being made is because the continent's changing. I think in recent years, to have a maid or an in-house servant, it's not so common anymore as well. So I think people are looking back and say, hold on, that's a bit strange somehow.
Well, indeed, it does seem as though the topic of being a maid in the movies is always rife with racial politics and cultural stigma, even going back to the early days of the talking picture. So let's take a look now at some other maids that have shaped our perceptions on the screen.
Who spends most of her time in the kitchen, but never seems to know what's cooking.
You take me to your apartment and I'll show you what I can do with a vacuum cleaner.
I really like this floor to shine. I mean, really shine. Now, to get it completely clean, it is necessary to get down on your hands and knees and scrub every little square inch by hand. No mop. Any questions?
When's lunch?
Just hold on and suck in.
Mammy, here's the scarlet pickles.
You can take it all back to the kitchen. I won't need to buy it.
Oh, yes, and you is. You's going to eat every mouthful of this.
What's your husband say you can pay?
Johnny doesn't know I'm bringing in help.
And what Mr. Johnny gonna do when he come home and find a colored woman in his house?
All my life I had to fight. I had to fight my daddy, I had to fight my uncles, I had to fight my brothers. But I never thought I had to fight in my own house.
You could be manager. Think of it, girl. One of us. Out there. In the blazer. Yeah.
A tiny glimpse there at how the depiction of maids has progressed over the years. We heard from Louise Beavers in TV's Beulah. There was Sandra Dee in That Funny Feeling. A clip in there from Made to Order with Ali Sheedy. Hattie McDaniel and Thelma McQueen in Gone with the Wind. Viola Davis in The Help. There was a clip from Made in Manhattan, starring Jennifer Lopez as well. And of course, Oprah Winfrey in The Color Purple. And that indeed brings us to the end of this week's show. Special thanks to my co-host today, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, our New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker at the Sundance Film Festival, and the Events Director of Programming, Trevor Groff. Today's show was edited by Nina Norick and researched by Yulene Goffin. Listen again and find out more at monocle.com or subscribe to the podcast at iTunes or SoundCloud. And of course, you can always get in touch with me by sending an email to br@monocle.com. The Cinema Show returns next week. Until then, I'm Ben Ryland. Thanks very much for listening.